Welcome to Double X Science. It's in your genes. Today is Friday, May 24th, 2013. I am Adrienne Rorick, chemistry editor, and with me today is Matthew Francis, physics editor at Double X Science. Good morning, Matthew. So this week, I'd like to know from you, other than Double X Science, where can our readers and listeners find your other work?
Catch-all site is called Bowler Hat Science, so it's bowlerhatscience.org. I also blog at galileospendulum.org, and you can find the stuff I write pretty frequently at Ars Technica. I also write for BBC Future and, most recently, the New Yorker's science blog.
Wow, so we can find you quite a few places.
One or two, yeah.
So let's move on to our week of posts. So speaking of writing that you've done, this week you have a post up at Double X Science called "Did Einstein Write His Most Famous Equation and Does It Matter?" Could you tell me a little bit about this post, Matthew?
Well, without a doubt, the most famous equation is E equals mc squared. And it might surprise a lot of people to find out that that was not an equation that Einstein used very often, at least in that form. This post came to me when I was looking at, it was something on IO9, where it was somebody had tracked down an old newspaper photo of Einstein giving a public lecture in Pittsburgh back in the 1930s, and it happened to be the only picture that had Einstein and a blackboard that had some equations on it together, and one of those equations wasn't E equals mc squared, as it turns out. But the thing is, what I started thinking was, why is this a big deal? Why is it a big deal to have a picture of Einstein with this equation in it? What difference does it make? I mean, we've got plenty of examples of Einstein's handwriting. Lord knows we've got lots of photos of Einstein. We don't really need more of those. So what was the big deal about having a photo of him with his equation in it? And so I started thinking about it, and I started looking around, and I remembered as I was working on this, that physicists rarely use the form E equals mc squared to begin with, because that is only going to be true. Energy is only going to be equal to mass times the speed of light squared if the mass isn't moving. And that's something physicists know, but it's not something that is generally known, I would say, among non-physicists. And so I thought, oh, well, maybe this is a chance to talk about what is the real meaning of the equation, why is it a big deal, and then why isn't it a big deal that we don't have a photo of Einstein with this equation? So it started with a cultural conversation and then went on into, why was the IO9 article not as big a deal?
You go on then to talk a little bit about what E equals mc squared really means, what the actual physics and implications are. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. Basically, the way to think about it is energy is the ability to do things in a simplified version of what we usually say in a more complicated way in physics. But that's what it boils down to. Energy is the ability to do things. You break chemical bonds, make a car start moving, and then on the more extreme end, split an atomic nucleus into pieces, or the energy that is released can be used to boil water or make a big explosion or something like that. But that's all energy is the ability to do things. What E equals mc squared means is that if you have a mass, a particle of any type that has mass, it will always possess some energy, even when it isn't moving. That's what E equals mc squared really means. You can increase the energy by having it move, but you can't decrease that energy. That's a bottom limit. And so Einstein realized that there was this absolute bottom, this absolute limit to how low the energy of an object could go. And of course, when you start looking at the implications of that, that's when you start getting into nuclear physics. That's where you start getting into why is the mass of a nucleus not equal to the sum of the masses of all the particles making it up. It's because some of that mass gets changed into energy to bind the nucleus together. The form E equals mc squared the reason why Einstein didn't like to use that himself is because he said, okay, this is what mass really means. So he liked to think of it as being m equals energy divided by the speed of light squared, which is, of course, the same equation. It's just rearranged slightly. But the difference is you're saying then, okay, the mass is what's left over when you take away everything else. You bring the particle to rest. You have its minimum energy. That minimum energy is basically the mass.
I see. Why do you think it is that people might be surprised that Einstein was not using the simplified version of his equations? He was a physicist, after all. Do they, say, not realize that physicists use the full Hamiltonians and quantum mechanic equations, and even classical physicists also have sort of large calculus-style equations that E equals mc squared would be a simplification of?
I would venture to say that people know the equation E equals mc squared, and they may even know what it means, but they don't always have the bigger context. The more general equation relating energy and mass also includes stuff like momentum, which is motion. It has to do with a particle in motion. That kind of concept is not a elementary school physics concept. Even if you learned about energy in school, you don't necessarily learn about momentum. You almost never learn about relativity. So to understand E equals mc squared fully, you do have to understand relativity. And ideally, you need to know, get into what we call space-time, the fact that time and space are not separate concepts. And so when you get into that, you realize, okay, energy is related to time and momentum is related to space. But what it means is that if you are moving at the same speed as a particle, that particle is basically at rest from your point of view. That's what relativity means. Measurements are made relative to the motion you have. What that means is you can take away the momentum of the particle, but there will always be a bit of residual energy left over.
Well, and at the end, you sum up the fact that Einstein's not the end-all and be-all on the subject of relativity. He was the first one. But indeed, there have been many physicists since Einstein to work on this theory of relativity and the E equals mc squared concept. And as you show with your cats, Pascal and Harriet, with a small selection. It looks like maybe you have a dozen books or so there, but you said you have around 64 books.
Yeah, if you count all the books I have that mention relativity in some significant way, it turns out to be, I would say, roughly
it's
half of the physics books I have.
Clearly a big, deep subject, and not going to be summed up on a chalkboard, even if Einstein's standing right next to it. Well, thank you for chatting with me about your post on XX Science this week. That post can be found by clicking on the link to the title on the main page, Did Einstein Write His Most Famous Equation? Does It Matter? Towards the end of the week, we had a post about Dr. Oz, where he's worried about your fillings, and this post was written by XX Science contributor Steven Salzberg. And this post did appear previously on the Forbes blog network. So this is a repost. It's about Dr. Oz, who I think is almost a common household name at this point in time. Wouldn't you agree, Matthew?
I would. I rarely watch TV, and I know his face and I know his name, and he's in magazines all the time. I notice him when I'm going through the supermarket checkout. There's Dr. Oz grinning at me from the front cover of a magazine.
I don't think I picked him out of a lineup, but I am familiar with his name and the sorts of things he talks about and pushes. It is frustrating because he's a medical doctor. He's had the full medical training, and he started out in the mainstream and has drifted.
I want to say he started as a cardiologist. That's not an easy profession to go into, so he obviously has medical credentials.
So what's his latest beef, so to speak?
A common thing for fillings, dental fillings in your teeth, is to use an alloy, a metal, a mixture of metals, including mercury. Well, mercury, of course, if you ingest mercury, it's toxic. It's a rather nasty poison. Recommended reading Deborah Bloom's The Poisoner's Handbook.
Right. Yeah, so that's kind of the point of this, right? That there are indeed toxic forms of mercury, but there are also really stable forms of mercury.
Right. And so just because there's mercury in your fillings does not automatically mean that you're ingesting poisonous substances on a steady basis just because you've got this
and
in your
so
mouth.
So this is where in the post they say that Dr. Oz is ignoring the science, because this toxicity of mercury and what forms are stable or not stable, which forms are actually the body is actually going to interact with, is pretty well known science. This is something I learned actually,
right,
you know, in the early years of my chemistry degree. But he's kind of ignoring some of those things, it sounds like.
Yeah. And of course, the thing that's striking too is that the way that Dr. Oz presents his argument is very alarmist. He says, if I drop this thermometer, you'd have to evacuate the studio. And if you brush your teeth, increase the mercury vapor and basically poison yourself just by brushing your teeth if you've got these things in your mouth.
The mercury amalgam is bound up in a pretty stable way. Brushing your teeth is not going to do that, especially if you consider that you have acid in your mouth. That would be actually more likely to cause any issues with fillings. And indeed, I think any more moving away from that sort of amalgam anyways in dental health, because those are silver-looking fillings, right? They're very clear in your mouth when you talk. And more people would prefer to have something that looks more like their teeth. So there's these new amalgams that look like your teeth. So I would say, even being alarmist about this, most people anymore aren't getting these kinds of fillings.
Right.
Yep. It's always really troubling with somebody with such credentials, and the fact that he is a professor of surgery at Columbia University, Columbia being very high-level university, but he's going off-stream. He's a surgeon. And as she says, if his show was about heart surgery, he probably knows his stuff hands down and none of us would even understand it. But he goes outside his expertise and starts talking about all these other health things and all this other science that he's demonstrating he is either not understanding or is just ignoring outright.
Right. And that's not to say that anybody talking outside of their area of expertise is automatically suspect, but you have to know that your source is trustworthy. But the problem is that Dr. Oz is trusted by many people and is willing to say stuff that is not correct, and there's nobody who is on his show providing a moderating view, nobody providing a here's what the science says on it. He's presenting an incorrect analysis and asking people to trust this incorrect analysis. And that's where it becomes a problem, because people will assume he's trustworthy on this subject when in fact he is not.
So, check it out, because I'm hoping that we will attract some of the people who aren't interested in the science, who are worried about their health, and they can see where listening to Dr. Oz in certain cases is maybe not the best, and to hear some other experts. In addition, we had quite a few other posts on XX Science this week. We had Parenting Paranoia Comes in Different Forms, which was a lot of fun to read as a parent, and even if you know parents and aren't a parent. We had Creating Viruses to Create the Vaccines. I learned quite a bit reading. I wasn't that familiar with this particular process. And What Causes Recurrent UTIs, where our tech editor, Jeffrey Perkel, discussed UTIs and the microbiome, which is his current theme. And we had another post in our I Am Mental Illness series called Not Knowing, and it's a post about severe depression and bipolar disorder. And you can find all those posts by going to our website, xxscience.org, and clicking on the title on the main page. We also have our XX Science Junior site, which is a site that has students writing to other students about science topics. We had Cubes, Pyramids, and More, which was a post about the Rubik's Cube. Stem Cell Talks, in which a high school student actually discusses all of this knowledge that she learned about stem cells and goes into the science behind them. So it was definitely a very educational read. And The Science of Napping, an infographic. Now on to our news. Matthew, what science news have you been reading this week?
It seems recently the one that is perhaps the most direct impact of science on people's lives was the story of the vote in Portland, Oregon over whether to fluoridate the water. A lot of places in the United States already do this, most municipalities, where you add a little bit of fluoride into the water supply, which studies over decades has been shown to actually help the health of teeth in your mouth. But the problem is, of course, that we are adjusting the level of fluoride that's already in the water. That's something that needs to be emphasized, isn't always emphasized. There's always naturally occurring chemical compounds in the water, and of course water itself is a chemical compound, H2O. So you're basically adjusting the water to boost something that's been shown to help teeth. But the problem is, of course, as soon as somebody says chemistry or chemical, it seems like many people worry that chemical equals harmful chemical.
That's been, I think, the case over the more recent decades. It's become chemical is equated with toxic rather than chemical just meaning in its pure form, elements bonded together.
Yeah, everything's chemical. Yeah. You breathe in chemicals. Oxygen is a chemical. There's no mystery in it. But when you are adding something to water, it sounds suspicious, even if it is not necessarily. And of course, as with anything, if you have too much fluoride, it can cause problems. But the amount that's added to water has been shown to be safe. It is nowhere close to the level where you're going to end up having problems. Most municipalities across the country already have fluoridated water, and we aren't dying in droves from this. Our teeth aren't turning black because of extra fluorine. It's rather concerning that Portland has rejected fluoridating the water, because it shows first that we who do science communication still have a ways to go in helping people understand it can be okay to do things like this. It can be okay to add stuff to water. It won't automatically be a problem. We like to think that we can explain to people exactly what I'm saying, that we can just go out and say, oh, you know, don't worry, it's all okay. But it's obvious that that isn't enough.
Well, it looks like Portland has been against fluoridation since the 1950s and only had a brief moment in the 1970s where they thought they might fluoridate their water and decided within a couple years that no, indeed, they did not wish to do that. It is sad because this has been shown to be a clear preventative measure for tooth decay, especially in children. This is a great way to get children this preventative treatment, which basically becomes free, and so you don't have to worry about having dental insurance and going to the dentist in order to receive like fluoride treatments and whatnot. So this is a big health issue, and it's sad that as many science issues are, that in Portland at least, it's a political issue. But it also shows in how different areas, different science becomes political issues. Most everywhere where fluoridation has been in the water since the 1950s, which is when most municipalities were adopting that, it's not even a consideration anymore. They're like, well, there's the science, it's there, it's good, we're good.
We don't notice it.
I don't think we've seen any adverse effects in those cities versus those in the cities that don't have the fluoridation. That wraps up our week at Double X Science. Thank you, Matthew, for joining me today. What can we look forward
to? Thank you. Well, next week we've got an interesting story about perhaps the panic over kids reaching puberty earlier than in the past that might not be quite as disturbing as we thought. Our very last installment of the I Am Mental Illness series, which has been running fairly regularly throughout this year, will occur on May 31st, which is Friday.
And thank you for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. If you are enjoying the podcast, please rate our podcast and leave a review at iTunes to help bring science to more people. Our music is provided by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. Our artwork is by Dallas Lopez. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at XXI. This has been Chemistry Editor Adrian Rorick and Physics Editor Matthew Francis. We are Double X Science, bringing science to the woman in you.
Just a final note that Double X Science podcast will be going on hiatus for the first portion of June.